This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Evan Wasuka. Coming up, Jacinda Ardern steps down as New Zealand's Prime Minister. What will this mean for Pacifica people? A Papua New Guinea morgue is renewing its calls for families to claim the bodies of loved ones as space runs out. And Pacific seasonal workers struggle through Queensland's bout of bad weather. More on those stories coming up. But first, Fiji's top military commander was summoned by the government after publicly raising concerns about the speed of political changes being made by the new government. His comments come just a fortnight after Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka took office. Major General Chone Kalanui sounded the alarm over what he said were shortcuts that could lead to long-term security consequences. The ABC's reporter in Fiji, Lithe Movono, with this report.
A statement to the media and an afternoon radio interview by the head of Fiji's military force, Chone Kalanui, set off alarm bells ringing in the capital, Suva.
The decision that they are making by the executive is having an effect on the judicial arm of government. And when that happens, then the integrity of the law and the constitution becomes a legitimate issue and under my responsibility with our mandate within the constitution, I'm obliged to share my concerns as such. I understand a lot of people have been asking and saying, you know, if the last government did it, why can't this government do it as well? I believe this is an opportunity for all of us to implement the right procedures to bring about the necessary changes that we abide by the rules, the procedures, the processes, and the law of this country.
He was then summoned to a meeting with Home Affairs Minister Pio Tikundundua. The commander was all smiles but tight-lipped as he walked through a gauntlet of questions from the media.
What do you mean by circumnavigating procedures and processes? So will you take over the government if you don't agree with what they're doing?
On the way out, he was still smiling and offered a few words.
Was it a pleasant meeting between you and the Home Affairs Minister?
Very much.
Will you be taking over the government at any time?
No.
Can you say something to the public who are anxious about your statement, sir?
The minister will provide a statement.
The Home Affairs Minister, Pio Tikundundua, was keen to reassure the public. Differences between the new government and the military were resolved.
The RFMS, like I said, is an institution that is created constitutionally. It has a role. Okay, that role, they have their own way of expressing that role, and that today the commander had made that decision. Okay. I am not submitting the government to that. Obviously, this is a democratic process that is a rule. So we are the elected government of the people, okay? Which is why I have summoned the commander down to tell him today of my concerns regarding what he has said.
The Home Affairs Minister says there will be no more media outbursts from the country's military. And he was also keen to point out who was calling the shot.
Today, the commander has assured that this is going to be the last time he will make such a public utterance like that.
As for Fiji's Prime Minister, Sitiveni Rambuka says he is not worried by the state of relations with the military. The former military commander says things couldn't be better.
I'm not concerned about that. When people in office are pushed and they feel that there needs to be a response given to a statement given in a medium, they must respond in that media. In this case, it was a newspaper, and he went to the newspaper.
So can you clarify, what is the role of the military with regards to insecurity or instability as per the statement that Kalanui has made?
They work in accordance with the directive of the government.
How would you describe your relationship with the military, your government's relationship with the military?
I have no concerns about my relationship with the military. I have every confidence in them, the leadership, the command, and the members of the force.
And he says the public too, which has been looking on with concern, should not be worried as well.
Do I look worried?
Should the people of Fiji be worried, sir?
No, they should not be worried.
Fiji's Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka ending that report from Lithe Movono in Suva. In her time as New Zealand's Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern was named the 2020 Pacific Person of the Year for her climate advocacy work. She also apologized for the 1970s dawn raids in New Zealand on Pacifica migrants that separated and devastated families. Professor Stephen Ratuva from the University of Canterbury says Prime Minister Ardern leaves behind a lasting legacy for the Pacifica community.
It's quite a big blow, particularly to the Pacific communities, to minorities, to women, to the progressive young population of New Zealand, because she was the icon of progressive politics, the icon of the climate issue, the icon of the globalization agenda, which connects New Zealand around the world with women, children, other socially progressive forces within the country.
And she came to power in 2017. What, on your reflections, do you think are some of the key moments in her rule for the Pacifica community in particular? There was, of course, her apology for the Dawn raids, her climate negotiations. What stands out for Pacifica communities in her term?
Yeah, there were a number of them. One was the apology, which was hasn't been done for a long time. It was very timely. And for the Dawn raid and for how the Pacific has suffered in New Zealand over in the past. Secondly, stand on the climate issues were very significant for the Pacific states and people. And she was very strong on that. And also, thirdly, her empathetic outlook towards minorities, particularly the Pacific. You visited the Pacific a number of times, different countries, and she was mobbed and hailed as a hero. And fourth, was the way in which she created that political space for the young Pacific people to have a hope in the future of the country. And the previous leadership had not provided that.
And looking forwards to the next leader to take over power in New Zealand, what will Pacifica communities be taking from Jacinda Ardern's leadership and looking towards the future?
Well, I suppose whoever takes over from Jacinda, it's very difficult. It's not easy because she has set a new standard, not only in terms of New Zealand, the region in the Pacific, but also globally. A number of things which the new leadership should be able to draw from Jacinda's leadership. One is empathy towards the multitude across the different ethnic and cultural and religious groups, and how that it is being projected much more genuinely and proactively rather than just symbolically and ticking the box type of approach. I remember the shooting in Christchurch. She became the global star in relation to how she was able to bring the country together and project New Zealand's approach globally. And secondly, is her potential ability for inclusion, to include lots of people within the state system, within the New Zealand society.
University of Canterbury's Professor Stephen Ratuva speaking there to Jordan Fennell. A non-government organisation from the UK say they will embed Solomon Islands police officers in their survey teams as part of an ambitious plan to rid the Solomons of unexploded World War II bombs. As Mackenzie Smith reports, the Halo Trust Group has taken over after a previous contractor ignored procedures, a move which led to the deaths of two of its employees and the suspension of its work.
In Solomon Islands, the legacy of World War II is still taking its toll today. An unknown number of unexploded ordnances are strewn across dozens of battle sites where the US and its allies fought Japan between 1942 and 1945. But as Simon Conway, who leads the Halo Trust's development team, says, the ongoing deaths from these bombs are a problem that's still largely undetected.
As someone that's worked in this industry for nearly 25 years, I hadn't realised the scale of contamination from Second World War unexploded ordnance in the Solomon Islands. I think that's partly because there's just really been no record keeping.
Halo Trust was founded in 1988 to help clear landmines and other explosive remnants in Afghanistan before expanding these efforts to 17 countries. The organisation is undertaking a first-of-its-kind survey after it was awarded $1 million in funding by the US Department of State in December. Those funds will go toward creating a map of all unexploded bombs, especially at the sites of famous battles like in Guadalcanal and New Georgia. It's the first time Mr. Conway has worked in the Solomon Islands. He says he hopes the survey will help the country present a strong case to the international community to support future work removing bombs.
I certainly see this as a route to significant clearance for humanitarian purposes across the island, so that, you know, people can you know, they can dig their ground safely.
HALO's contract in Solomon Islands is the first the US has supported since the NGO Norwegian People's Aid, which was cut short when two of its staff died from an old mortar shell explosion in 2020. An investigation by the NGO later found the pair had been handling the shell at their office and residence in breach of the organisation's rules. This time around, Simon Conway says there are stricter measures in place.
I had very frank conversations with the Solomon Islands government about, and you know, of course, they are justifiably concerned about it. But we've come to an agreement that there will be no movement of ordnance, which I'm thoroughly in favour of. And we also, I made a bid to them that we would actually embed members of the police EOD unit in our survey team. That would, I think, on the one hand, you know, increase the confidence in, as they see the work that we're doing, but also, frankly, it would benefit us.
Still, there are signs the 2020 incident has damaged trust between the police and international contractors. Karen Galokale, Permanent Secretary for the Solomon Islands Ministry of Police, National Security and Correctional Services, which coordinates clearing unexploded bombs, was quoted by Hawaii news site Civil Beat saying she was concerned there wasn't a memorandum of understanding struck with the HALO Trust. She declined to be interviewed by Pacific Beat. John Rodsted, Pacific Islands Coordinator for Safe Ground, an Australian NGO working to eradicate the harm from unexploded bombs, says cooperation between HALO and other partners in Solomon Islands will be critical.
The Solomons, in landmass and in where they actually have to go, it's really not that hard. But I hope they don't just go out and reinvent the wheel. Use the information that's available.
He says Australian forces stationed in Solomons could also provide vital assistance. HALO's Simon Conway says no matter how successful the survey is, the problem of unexploded bombs won't be going away anytime soon.
There's a lot of ammunition dumps in some of the remoter islands. I don't think we're going to finish the survey in 2 years, but we should get a really good picture of the problem by then.
HALO says in addition to the survey, it will construct storage for ammunition and detonators and support the Solomon Islands government in drafting new regulations for dealing with explosives.
Mackenzie Smith reporting. Papua New Guinea's largest hospital is calling for families to come in and claim the bodies of loved ones. The morgue at Port Moresby General Hospital has been overflowing, forcing the hospital to resort to mass burials. Hospital Director Kone Sobi says their facilities are outdated and they're struggling to cope with the increasing number of bodies.
Right now, there are about 230 or 40 bodies in the morgue system. The capacity of the morgue is about 164, so we're actually way over the capacity. All the bodies, in fact, are in the cooling system, but we're stacking them up. Not a nice way of ending with deceased persons, but that's the situation we are in. So we're going to carry out this mass burial, and hopefully that will bring the number down to capacity where we can be able to manage on a daily basis. Deaths that we are admitting to the morgue system consist of deaths within the hospital and deaths from outside. From last year's figures, we had over 4,000 bodies admitted to the morgue system, and 55% were deaths that occurred outside of the hospital. So yes, there's a huge strain on the hospital systems. So our biggest appeal is for relatives to come forward, pick up the bodies, and then bury them in a more dignified way than the mass burial. There are plans to improve the situation, but all of that also is hinging on our mortuary policy, which we are developing.
And what are these changes that you are suggesting?
One of the things that we are proposing in our policy is to charge fees for morgue so that we can rehabilitate the morgue facility. The morgue facility was built by JICA, Japanese International Cooperation Agency, almost 30 years ago. And it was built for a population that was much less than what it is today, for a capacity of 64, you know, bodies at one time in the chillers. But over the years, we've added several containers. In fact, during the COVID surges in 2020 and 2021, we added two 20-foot containers. So at the moment, we have, apart from the chillers, which can cater for 60. In the main mortuary building, we have four 20-foot containers adjacent to the main building and a 40-foot container. There are plans to bring in one more 40-foot container, and then we have plans to rehabilitate the layout room and an autopsy room. So those are some of the plans. But, you know, of course, this require, you know, funds, and so we are proposing that we charge nominal fees much less than what is charged at the private funeral homes we have in the city.
And do you think people will be able to afford that fee?
That's something for, you know, the community to give us a feedback once we make this policy known to the community. But having said that, you know, there's a fees are much less. I mean, you're talking about 500 kina upfront payment for bodies brought in from outside, 50 kina daily, you know, 7 days afterwards. The idea is so that people will come and get their bodies out rather than keeping them storage for very, very long time.
Do we have any idea as to why people are not picking up the bodies?
Population increase is one, you know, major factor. The biggest factor, I believe, is families find it very difficult to repatriate their bodies on if they're dead from, you know, either central, nearby central provinces, you know, or other provinces, then they have difficulty with repatriating bodies home. And so they just basically leave them for such long time. You know, if you think about some of the bodies in there for 10 months, you know, it's just simply unacceptable. Some of the deaths, not many, but a couple of deaths we have noted, these are people that we don't even know their names. They are, you know, brought very sick or very brawl or something like that, and people just bring them, police bring them, and so we can't identify them, you know, we don't know where they're from. They're Papua New Guineans, but we don't know where they live. There's no address. We don't know their name because, you know, they may come either dead on arrival or they're so severely injured, traumatic brain injury. And then they, you know, after some time in the hospital, they pass away. And so that's a small proportion of deaths in that situation where it appears like no one really notices, you know, if someone is missing in the society.
Dr. Konesobi, Director of Medical Services at Port Moresby General Hospital, and he was talking there to Dubravka Volodyr. The people of Tonga this week mark the one-year anniversary of the Hunga Tonga Hunga Haapai volcanic eruption and tsunami. Mercifully, the number of fatalities was small, but large numbers of Tongans were driven from their homes permanently. With internet and communication links disrupted, Brisbane broadcaster Sulian Late was the main outlet of news from Tonga. Since then, he's been honoured by being installed as a chief attendant to King Tupou VI, a role that allows him to speak on His Majesty's behalf. He says Tongans around the world held their own commemorations.
Absolutely, and not just in Brisbane, but most of the Tongan denominations across Australia and the diaspora community, definitely it was a reflective mood yesterday. And also on Saturday as well on Pacifica TV and radio, we also broadcast a special reflective program, bringing together some of the various church ministers from around Australia through that program as well.
So what did it mean to the people of Tonga to be able to reflect on those terrible events of 12 months ago?
I think it's actually brought up a lot of emotions as people have sort of paused, taken a moment to reflect of what actually occurred back 12 months ago, and also a time to look at the support that the diaspora put together over the last 12 months, you know, through taking of supplies back to Tonga through containers. And in addition to that as well, there was obviously a lot of monetary support sent back to family and friends, and to also sort of look back and see how have we gone with the recovery process back in Tonga.
And I understand there was an exhibition also held as part of the anniversary commemoration in Tonga. Do you know what that exhibition involved?
Yeah, absolutely. So government departments, NGOs, and some of the private sector got together and put on an exhibition which was held at the Queen Salote Memorial Hall in the heart of Nuku'alofa. Those displays included each department from the government, the NGOs, had displays with photographs, pictures showing the relief efforts, showing the damage of various areas and showing efforts up to this stage where they've gone in terms of recovery, rebuilding the infrastructure that was impacted, both natural infrastructure as well as the physical infrastructure. Of course, there was, you know, geologists display and so forth. So it was an opportunity for both the public as well as various departments to come together to walk through those displays and reflect and to see the journey of what had occurred in Tonga right through until the recovery efforts up to date.
Mango and Atata Islands especially were devastated by the disaster and they're now deserted. Their populations have just been resettled in new communities in recent weeks. As far as you know, have those resettlements all gone smoothly?
Displacement was definitely one of the key issues that the Tongan government obviously had to deal with in the wake of the tsunami and the volcanic eruption. And some of those people were residing in community halls, church halls for almost a year until just a few weeks ago where they've been relocated. Generally speaking, and I was in Tonga a few weeks ago, that process has gone quite smoothly. But at the same token that, you know, there's a few members of those community groups that are longing to go back to the islands, keeping in mind that their ancestors are buried on those islands, that there's unique links to those areas. And of course, for some of the people from those islands, you know, they were fisher people and so forth, and now they've been moved to completely different locations and areas. So it's a big adjustment for these people, notwithstanding also the trauma that people have gone through as well, and not going back home, but going to a different area as well, also conjures constantly the reason that why we were moved in the first place. So it's an interesting transition for these people. But of course, the government and the other NGOs have worked hard to rebuild some infrastructure in new areas for them. We need to take the advice from scientists and geologists and so forth in preparation that this could happen again in the future, and their islands have been deemed not safe for them to rebuild there. So hopefully moving forward, they're in a lot more safer zones for protection against future tsunamis.
I was reading earlier a story of a man, I believe he was from Atata Island, and he got actually washed out to sea and he had to swim some incredible distance, and then he basically washed up on the beach at Nuku'alofa, and his whole family thought that he had died. What do you think when you hear these stories?
I think for us living in the diaspora and given Tonga Tapu's geography, it's a very flat island, of course. And I think well before this tsunami happened, people were always the Tongan community would often joke and say, oh gosh, you know, when a tsunami ever happened, you know, Tonga Tapu would be gone. It's as flat as a pancake, you know, there's no mountains and so on. And then when this actually occurred, the immediate concern from diaspora straight away was that the death toll would be huge given Tonga's geography. However, hearing those survival stories and hearing that the death toll was so incredibly low was just absolutely, you know, that was so shocking in itself. I believe that everyone, you know, all experts included, were expecting a much higher death toll. So that survival story was phenomenal when we heard it. And as we got the statistics coming in terms of, you know, what areas were damaged and what areas survived, I think even to now, we're just thanking God that it could have been so much worse.
Sulian Late, broadcasting to the Tongan diaspora from Brisbane and the chief attendant to King Tupou VI. And he was speaking there to Nick Fogarty. Work has been halted for Pacific seasonal workers in North Queensland, who were forced to bunker down as extreme levels of rainfall battered the state. Almost 3 months' worth of rain fell over 3 days this week, causing rivers to overflow and supermarket shelves to be stripped bare of supplies. Junior Paul is a fruit picker from Papua New Guinea based in North Queensland.
We've been facing almost 2 weeks now. Last week and this week it still continued rain, night, day and night, and lots of our areas have been blocked because roads have been blocked because of flood. So all the cars, caravan, whatever that go across, they want to go to Bowen. The road have been blocked and now they're just staying in Discovery Park where we live in. Yeah, lots of them. And we've been facing some areas like little floods in where the parks got waters and all this water have been like go through and like come across some houses, and where we live also, it's been like flood and there's water everywhere and under the houses, there's water.
Well, flash flooding has been reported widespread across the region. Now, you're a fruit picker currently based in Eyre, which for the listeners who don't know is based about an hour north of the Whitsundays in North Queensland. How long have you been working up there?
Almost 1.5 years now.
And you mentioned that the road's been cut off and everything like that. Have you been able to work during all this rainfall?
Now at the moment, because of rain, and we were not working because of rain, and like the area is flood and in paddock is wet, so we cannot do some work.
So what have you and your fellow workers been doing while you've been off work?
We just staying at home. We're just sleeping and all this. We've got continued rain. And
have you still being looked after by your employer? You've still got money coming in your bank account and things like that to get supplies?
Yeah, according to our leave, annual leave, because we were under like PLS, so we still got the annual leave. Yeah, so when we were not work, we still pay under the annual leave.
That was North Queensland-based fruit picker Junior Paul speaking there to reporter Kyle Evans. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Review for this week. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for listening. And do join us again same time next week for more news and views from around the Pacific.